3. Zombified. In E.B. White's classic Charlotte's Web, a spider weaves the word terrific and other messages into her web in a bid to save a porcine friend from the slaughterhouse. My childhood wonderment at her cleverness came flooding back to me on seeing the photo of a real-life spider whose web, though scarcely the supernatural feat of Charlotte's, was nonetheless strikingly original. The eight-legged creature, a tropical orb spider known as Allocyclosa bifurca, had abandoned its normal tight-knit circular motif in favor of a sprawling, free-form style unlike anything I'd ever seen emanating from the arachnid school of design. Asymmetric, with silk threads meeting in a kaleidoscope of angles, it looked like the creation of a spider tripping on LSD. As it turned out, my impression wasn't far off the mark. The spider had indeed been drugged. Not by a scientist, as I'd initially suspected, but by a parasitic wasp, Polysphincta gutfreundi. Its tyranny over the spider begins when the wasp seizes hold of the spider and deposits an egg onto its abdomen. As the egg matures into a worm-like larva, it makes little holes in the spider's abdomen through which it sucks out juices. With this dependable source of nutrients, the larva grows rapidly while the spider continues building normal webs and capturing prey. After about a week, the wasp larva starts injecting chemicals that induce the spider to, effectively, build it a nursery. The resulting net-like structure, which bears little resemblance to the spider's usual web, has reinforced lines that will better withstand the strong winds and rains of tropical storms. And thanks to its aerial perch, the developing larva will be kept safe from predators on the ground. Lest a bird or lizard attempt to raid the nursery, the spider even weaves a special decoration that will conceal the parasite's presence. The spider's reward for all its hard work? Just as it's putting the final touches on the wasp's nursery, the larva kills it, sucks it dry of body fluids, and drops its desiccated carcass to the ground. The wasp larva, which has a single row of stubbly legs that are covered at their tips with tiny hooks, then suspends itself from its custom-designed web and creates a cocoon. There, encased like a mummy, it will molt one last time and emerge as an adult wasp. Numerous parasitic wasps exploit different species of orb spiders in a similar fashion. William Eberhard, an entomologist and arachnologist at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute and the Universidad de Costa Rica, discovered the phenomenon in 2000, but he chides himself for not having uncovered the manipulation decades earlier. The strategy is very common, he admits. Now 70, the silver-haired scientist has been fascinated by spiders since his days as an undergraduate at Harvard. When he took a tedious job in the basement of the university's Museum of Comparative Zoology, replenishing alcohol that evaporated from jars holding invertebrate specimens. He hated the work in the dank, dark setting, but the curator of the collection eventually took pity on him, invited him upstairs, and taught him how to catalog spiders according to their kinship. Viewed up close, as he searched for characteristics they had in common, they became objects of beauty, as familiar to him as gems to a jeweler. With an eye finely tuned to discern their morphology and habits, he'd spotted several bizarre-looking webs over the years, ones made by orb spiders in a style as jarring a departure from their normal design as realism is from abstract expressionism. What's more, on closer inspection, he invariably found wasp cocoons hanging from these strange webs. But I didn't stop to think about exactly how that could have happened, he said. I sort of had the idea that the spider basically got weakened by the wasp's larva on its abdomen, so it just didn't have the strength to build a normal web. Since lots of organisms are sickened by parasites, he dismissed the phenomenon as unimportant. Eberhard can't recall what prompted him to finally question that assumption, but one day it hit him. Hey, you idiot, this is interesting. Indeed, when he turned his full attention to the phenomenon, he was astonished. I realized that the story of the spider being weak and pathetic and hardly able to move was completely wrong, he said. It was full of energy and working right along, but making something very different. As best as he can tell, the larva employs a cocktail of chemicals, some of which act on the spider's central nervous system to alter its behavior, and others, or perhaps a single compound, that poison it when its work is done. In one intriguing experiment, he plucked off the larva just before it was about to kill the spider, and the spider not only made a full recovery, but its weaving style gradually returned to normal, only in reverse, meaning the last alterations in its design were the first to vanish. That leads him to believe that as the concentration of the cocktail increases, the behavioral effects become more pronounced. Hence, when levels fall upon removal of the parasite, the spider modifies its spinning style in backward order. But that's just a guess, he cautions. And he hasn't a clue how the wasp's chemical signaling system can be so incredibly selective in affecting some portions of the host's behavior and not others. These are very, very fine instructions that it's giving to the spider. This is not some general order like climb up or jump in the water. To add to the challenge of determining the underlying mechanism, many different types of orb spiders are parasitized by an equally diverse group of wasps. So there seems to be endless permutations in how such manipulations are executed. And the wasp-induced webs themselves are so varied that Eberhard has no idea what to expect from unusual pairings. As happened when, on a walk through a Costa Rican coffee field, he spotted the larva of a rare wasp clinging to the abdomen of a common spider, Leucogy mariana. He placed the spider, with the larva still attached, in a jar, hoping that it would continue weaving in captivity, something many spiders are reluctant to do. To his delight, the prisoner adapted well to its cramped cell and immediately got busy. He put a curled piece of paper in the jar. Spiders have trouble anchoring their threads to glass, and the creature began attaching its line of sticky thread to a surprisingly large number of points on the sheet's curved inner surface. His surprise turned into shock when he realized what the spider was doing. Instead of limiting itself to a two-dimensional, planar construction, as is the custom of this species, it branched out into three dimensions. He'd never seen this kind of spider make anything even remotely like it. The web's lines all converged on a central area, where the spider wove a fine meshed strip-like platform. And instead of suspending itself from the web, as is the habit of parasitic wasps, the cocooned larva lay sideways on the platform as if taking a nap. Another type of wasp, a much more prevalent variety, also parasitizes this species of spider. But the spell it casts couldn't be more different. In response to its larva, the spider makes a simpler, more streamlined version of its normal planar web, with far fewer spokes radiating from the center, and no threads spanning them. Instead of an ornate 3D structure, the result is a skeletal web completely devoid of the host's trademark circular motif. Each species of wasp, it seems, has its own unique potion for bewitching the spider. They're also brilliant at taking advantage of what a spider normally does and adapting that behavior to suit their own needs. For example, Eberhard said, if a species of spider lives in a sheltered retreat, the wasp might induce it to put a door on the retreat to protect its cocoon. Or if a spider normally weaves decorations designed to camouflage itself, the wasp harnesses that talent to conceal its cocoon from its enemies. Simply put, these parasitic wasps know how to get the most out of a host. Spiders are by no means the only creatures that need to fear the parasitic wasp's coercive tactics. And drugs are not the wasp's only weapons for gaining the compliance of their victims. Ampulex compressa, better known as the jewel wasp because of its iridescent blue-green sheen, performs neurosurgery to achieve its aims. Its quarry is the annoyingly familiar American cockroach, Periplaneta americana, not to be confused with the comparatively diminutive German roach common up north, This species prefers warmer climes and can grow as big as a mouse. Though dwarfed in stature by its prey, a female jewel wasp that has caught the scent of an American roach will aggressively pursue and attack it, even if that means following the fleeing insect into a house. The roach puts up a mighty struggle, flailing its legs and tucking in its head to fend off the attack, but usually to no avail. With lightning speed, the wasp stings the roach's midsection, injecting an agent that will temporarily paralyze it so that the behemoth will stay still for the delicate procedure to follow. Like an evil doctor wielding a syringe, she again inserts her stinger, this time into the roach's brain, and gingerly moves it around for half a minute or so until she finds exactly the right spot, whereupon she injects a venom. Shortly thereafter, the paralytic agent delivered by the first sting wears off. In spite of having full use of its limbs and the same ability to sense its surroundings as any normal roach, it's strangely submissive. The venom, according to Frederick Liebersat, a neuroethologist at Ben Gurion University in Israel, has turned the roach into a zombie that will henceforth take its orders from the wasp and willingly tolerate her abuse. Indeed, the roach doesn't protest in the least when she twists off part of one of its antennae with her powerful mandible and proceeds to suck the liquid oozing from it like soda from a straw. The wasp then does the same thing to its other antenna and, assured that the roach will go nowhere, leaves it alone for about 20 minutes as she searches for a burrow where she'll lay an egg to be nourished by the roach. Meanwhile, her brainwashed slave busies itself grooming, picking fungal spores, tiny worms, and other parasites off itself, providing a sterile surface for the wasp to glue its egg. When the wasp returns, she seizes the roach by the stump of one of its antennae and walks it like a dog on a leash to her burrow, said Liebersat. Thanks to its cooperation, she doesn't have to waste energy dragging the massive roach. Equally important, he said, she doesn't need to paralyze all the respiratory system, so the thing will stay alive and fresh. Her larvae need to feed 5 or 6 days on this fresh meat, which you don't want to rot. The wasp enters the burrow first, tugs the cockroach in behind her, lays an egg on the exoskeleton of its leg, and then leaves to search for twigs and debris to stop up the opening, thus entombing the fully alert roach. Her offspring then proceeds to clean out the roach's body from top to bottom, at which point the fledgling wasp emerges from the burrow to repeat the cycle. With the goal of understanding how the wasp dominates her much larger host, Liebersat's team fed the winged tyrant a radioactive compound that was incorporated into her venom. When the wasp stung a roach, the researchers could then track where the poison went. They discovered that the venom knocked out a vital neural center for decision-making. Basically, information from the roach's eyes and other sensory organs is relayed to this nexus, and after processing these inputs, the insect chooses what to do next. As Liebersat explains, roaches aren't automatons that react to stimuli in the same way every time. Just like us, they can be unpredictable. They think before acting, which is why they're so good at escaping humans chasing after them with rolled-up newspapers. So when the venom knocks out that central command module, the creature is effectively robbed of free will. Instead of running for its life, it's frozen by indecision. All it takes is a little tug by the wasp to get it over its inertia, and off it trots to its death. Just how the wasp guides her stinger to this critical brain region, a knot of neurons half as big as a pinhead, proved a much tougher riddle for Liebersat's team to solve. Her precision, he said, is on par with medicine's most advanced systems for locating and destroying very small targets in the brain. To coax the wasp into yielding up her secret, the researchers played a trick on her. They removed the roach's brain, and then gave the insect to her to see what she would do. The wasp probed the creature's head for nearly 8 minutes before giving up in frustration. That and other experiments eventually enabled them to crack the mystery. The end of the wasp's stinger, they discovered, has special mechanoreceptors that sense tension and pressure. When the stinger reaches the sheath that encapsulates the insect's brain, it hits a slightly resistant material that bends. That tells the wasp, "Push here and then spray," he said. "It's kind of like a tactile sensation." As if her state-of-the-art surgical skills weren't impressive enough, the jewel wasp is also a creative chemist. Analyzing the insect's venom, Liebersat's team was intrigued to discover that one of its ingredients is dopamine, a neurotransmitter known to initiate grooming in rats. Could the chemical, they wondered, explain how the wasp induces the roach to clean itself of parasites that might harm her larva? Sure enough, injecting dopamine into an unstung roach triggered grooming. Dopamine also has a profound effect on an animal's motivation, offering another hint to how the wasp tames its quarry. These wasps are way better at manipulating the neurochemistry of their prey than are the neuroscientists who study them, marveled Liebersat. In other corners of nature, parasites manipulate their hosts for very different reasons. A barnacle in the genus Sacculina, for instance, seeks to divert a crab's attention from its young to the care and nurturing of the barnacle's own offspring. It may be hard to imagine a barnacle capable of hatching such a plan, much less having the talent to carry it out. But Sacculina is decidedly unconventional by the standards of its clan. It does not have a shell and does not attach itself to rocks, seaweed, or anything else. Sacculina resembles a bundle of roots that have invaded the soft, fleshy interior of the crab like a metastatic cancer. If any real-life entity fits the nightmarish image of a body snatcher, it's this barnacle. In its infancy, the parasite is a free-living larva that swims around until, guided by scent, it alights upon a crab. A female Sacculina, the larva come in two sexes, then drives a sharp, dagger-shaped part of her exoskeleton through the crab's thick armor. Through the tip of this weapon, she then injects a tiny, worm-shaped clump of her cells, leaving behind her bulky outer coat. Once inside, her cells grow into a thick tangle of roots, eventually invading the crustacean's eye stalks, nervous system, and other organs. The crab continues to behave like its uninfected kin, trolling the shore and munching on mollusks. But the food it gathers fuels Sacculina's efforts to overthrow its rule, which eventually entails sterilizing the animal, a favorite trick of parasitic manipulators. The crustacean ceases to mate or grow any larger and henceforth lives only to feed the barnacle and help it reproduce. In the spot where a female crab normally sprouts a pouch on her belly to hold her brood, the colonizer pushes out her tendrils and grows a brood pouch of her own. Guided by smell, two male larvae will find their way to the chamber and begin fertilizing the female's eggs. In effect, these two males become an integrated part of the female, said Jens Hoag, an expert on parasitic barnacles. She becomes functionally a hermaphrodite. As the eggs develop, the crab keeps the parasite's pouch clean by brushing off algae and other parasites, and when they hatch, the crustacean migrates to deeper water. There, it liberates the hatchlings in great pulses and stirs the currents with its claws to send them on their way. And so the barnacle's babies will be carried off by the tide to commandeer other crabs. Don't think the host's service to the parasite is over, however. Quite the opposite. It's just begun. Sacculina will keep churning out new batches of eggs, and every few weeks the crab will return to deeper water to repeat the same ritual of dispersing the parasite's offspring. For the rest of the crustacean's life, it will cease to have a will of its own. It's not just female crabs that are forced into a lifetime of servitude. The barnacle can turn a he into a she. Normally, male crabs have narrow abdomens. But once invaded by Sacculina, his body assumes the broader shape of the female's, and it also develops a pouch to hold the parasite's young. Completing this sex change, The feminized male displays the maternal instincts that will make him a tender and protective caretaker of the parasite's brood. From Scandinavia and Hawaii to the southern coast of Australia, the world is home to over 100 species of Sacculina, and the parasitic barnacle infects a stunning percentage of crabs in certain localities. In Danish fjords, as much as 20%. In Hawaii, 50%. And in some parts of the Mediterranean, 100%. You can identify the infected crabs by the yellow, mushroom-like growths on their undersides, the parasite's pouch. Because infected crabs can no longer molt to grow a larger shell, they also tend to be covered by seaweed and barnacles. Ordinary, non-invasive ones, that is. Should you encounter one of these hybrid creatures scurrying along the shoreline, stop to admire the parasite's achievement. That eight-legged form may act like any other crab, but it's really an amphibious robot. Fungi would seem to have little in common with parasitic barnacles, but one type seizes control of its host, a carpenter ant, by colonizing its body in a similar fashion. That's not to say its tactics are exactly the same. It doesn't exploit parental affection for its own gain, but its ultimate goal is identical. It wants its host to seek out an ideal spot to spread its offspring and give them a bright start in life. Even when this fungus, Ophiocordyceps, is a mere spore, there's nothing docile in its manner. When it comes into contact with a carpenter ant, the spore sprouts tendrils that burrow into the insect and quickly invade its entire body. It then commands the ant to climb a sapling at exactly solar noon. About 1 foot up, the insect moves to the underside of a leaf on the northwestern side of the plant and clamps down on its main vein, a sturdy point of attachment. At the same time, the fungus destroys the muscles that control its mandibles, guaranteeing that its jaws will stay forever clenched. Frozen like a statue, the host dies, and out of its head springs the fungus, a single stalk that grows a fruiting body at its tip. It soon bursts, spraying spores down onto the ground, where new ants pick them up. David Hughes, an Irish-born entomologist at Pennsylvania State University, was the first to document the phenomenon. Some of my early papers in 2004 and 2006 were rejected because people just didn't believe it, he reported. Zombie ants, as he refers to them, not only exist, but are very common. In rainforests around the world, as many as 22 of their grisly cadavers can be found per square yard, or, for those who prefer the metric system, 26 per square meter. I call these dense graveyards the killing fields, he said. To understand the fungus's quirky commands to the ant, Hughes has moved leaves with zombie ants attached to them to slightly higher or lower elevations or different sides of the plant. The transplanted fungi aren't as successful in propagating themselves in these cases, so clearly there is an evolutionary logic behind the parasite's very precise commands to the ant. But Hughes is hard-pressed to determine what it is. He believes that it might have something to do with the fungus thriving in cool temperatures and very humid air. The northwestern side of the plant gets less sun, and lower leaves are more likely to be cast in shade. How the fungus gets the ant to clamp down on the main vein of a leaf completely mystifies him, however. That's not part of the ant's normal behavior, so there's no a priori reason to think it would be able to tell the vein from the lamina. Why it bites at solar noon is also perplexing to him, but he theorizes it might be related to the fact that 4 hours later, coinciding with sunset, the fungus will be moving from the inside to the outside of the ant, a rough transitional period when it's at greater risk of dying. Nightfall provides the dark, humid conditions conducive to its growth, so it may be trying to synchronize a vulnerable point in its development to coincide with that advantageous time of day. In addition to his fieldwork, Hughes studies the manipulation in his lab, where he keeps the ant's brains alive in jars. The organ doesn't need a body to function. To these containers, he then adds fungi. As the parasite begins to sprout, it produces a slew of chemicals, a few of which mirror compounds found in the ant's body. But he suspects it may also use foreign chemicals to control the ant, notably a powerful hallucinogen. His hunch is based on the parasite's close kinship to the ergot fungus from which LSD is derived. So far, every manipulator I've highlighted has been a parasite, but not all of them fit that mold. Some manipulators alter the behavior of another creature for their own gain, but offer a benefit in return. In that sense, they might more aptly be called symbionts. Since these kinder rulers also challenge the notion that one's thoughts are strictly one's own, I will be including symbionts in future discussions. What's more, we ourselves may be influenced by them. Bacteria that normally live in the human body are suspected of manipulating our behavior to both their and our advantage. We will get to them later. But let's now turn our attention to a benevolent manipulator that involves humans only tangentially, but will nonetheless make coffee and tea lovers smile. The story features a drug peddler with petals, that fragrant delight we call a flower. It begins over a decade ago, when German pharmaceutical researchers discovered that several varieties of flowers laced their nectar with caffeine. Geraldine Wright, an American neuroethologist at Newcastle University in England, came across a report of their findings and was dumbfounded. Caffeine in seeds and leaves is nothing new. It's toxic and bitter-tasting to insects, so plants often use the compound to repel them. But finding an insecticide in nectar was the last thing she'd expected. After all, it's the sweet food that flowering plants use to entice bees to pollinate them. As she read on, however, she noticed that the amount of caffeine in nectar was much less than in other parts of the plant, which suggested bees might not even be able to detect it. For years, Wright had been studying bees with the goal of understanding the mechanisms underpinning human learning and memory because at a molecular level, bees' brains are quite similar to our own. So she began to contemplate whether such a low dose of caffeine might affect them like a stimulant as it does for us. Then inspiration struck. Maybe flowers, she thought, were using the drug to improve the insect's memory so that it would return to cross-pollinate them. The bee might also benefit from remembering where an excellent source of nectar is located. Wright had the ideal skill set to investigate that hunch. She's also, not surprisingly, a pro at handling bees and unafraid of their sting. Before speaking with her, I went to her university website, where I found a photo of her clad in a bee bikini, a swarm of the insects discreetly shielding her delicate female parts from view. Bee bikinis and beards are a macho thing that beekeepers do, she said. But while she had the know-how and chutzpah to test what caffeine does to bees, she lacked the means. Like many a struggling scientist, Wright had no funding, forcing her to underwrite the project herself. On her own dime, she traveled to Costa Rica to gather nectar from the flowers of coffee plants, the obvious choice to test her theory. It took 2 months of labor. Time, it turned out, ill-spent. Her suitcase containing vials of the substance was lost by baggage handlers at Heathrow Airport in London. Again at her own expense, she flew back to the country to repeat the task. "Don't feel too badly for me," she said. "I had a lot of fun. It doubled as a vacation." Several months later, she finally had enough coffee nectar to begin testing her theory in her UK lab. But to her dismay, she found that her bees had superb recall with or without a boost from caffeine. After scratching her head, she decided that maybe the memory test she'd given the bees had been too easy. She'd trained them to recognize a single floral scent and measured how well they could remember it the next day. But in the wild, bees jump from flower to flower every 30 seconds, which means they have to remember hundreds of scents over the span of a day or two. In human terms, she said, it's comparable to cramming for an exam, which requires you learn a whole bunch of information in a very little time, versus studying less information over a longer period of time, when people remember much better. She raised the difficulty of the memory test and struck scientific gold. The bees did abysmally without caffeine. but when they got the normal dose in their nectar, they performed almost perfectly. It was quite a stunning result. I think this is the first case where we see a pharmacological manipulation of an animal by a plant. Based on body size, Wright calculates that the insects consume a dose of the drug roughly equivalent to what a human gets from a weak cup of coffee. Could flowers be manipulating us, too? Probably, Wright laughed. But more, she clarified, as a side effect of evolution. Because the human brain shares common building blocks with that of bees, she believes, caffeine influences our cognitive functioning, too. We famously rely on it to stay alert and productive. In short, to give us that buzz we envy in bees. But oddly, it's not clear whether caffeine improves human memory. Some research indicates it doesn't. But when scientists at Johns Hopkins University recently looked at one very specific type of recall not carefully studied before, they found that it may be a memory booster after all. Intriguingly, the drug improves a kind of recollection we rely on for telling apart very similar but very different objects, such as types of cars, hammers, or, ironically, flowers. It's pretty funny when you think about it, said Wright. Caffeine is the most widely used drug in the world, and bees have been consuming it tens of millions of years before we showed up on the planet. There's another amusing twist to her findings. Among the multitudes of flowering plants found on Earth, according to her, very few have caffeine in their nectar. Yet this tiny minority of plants is among the most widely cultivated today. In addition to the coffee plant, these include tea, cacao, from which we make chocolate, and kola, a popular nut chewed in equatorial Africa. As Wright Riley notes, we like how caffeine makes us feel, so you could say that these flowering plants manipulate us by getting us to grow vast plantations of them. During this whirlwind tour of manipulators, I've repeatedly trumpeted their cleverness. But before we move on, it's important to note that manipulators can make mistakes. They can get confused and jump aboard the wrong vehicle, by which I mean a species that cannot further their reproductive goals. The parasite steers itself into an evolutionary dead end. This happens more frequently than you might think. Indeed, manipulators can cause massive collateral damage, an unfortunate fact of life that is commonly overlooked when calculating the full extent of their influence on animal and human behavior. Which brings us to the cat parasite.